You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more than 1,000 women wrote to the Washington Post sharing their stories about living alone during the pandemic. We'll hear some of their stories and the creative ways they're coping. First, the novel coronavirus isn't the first outbreak to capture much of the world's attention in recent years. There was the Ebola outbreak that affected parts of West Africa between 2014 and 2016, and the Zika virus epidemic that hit Brazil and eventually made its way to the U.S. around the same time. But it turns out there are some big differences between many of the most recent outbreaks and the novel coronavirus. And those differences help explain why the new virus has had such a huge effect around the globe. Kaylee Rogers is a reporter covering politics and technology for 538. She wrote the piece there, "Why Did the World Shut Down for COVID-19 But Not Ebola, SARS, or Swine Flu?" Kaylee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's look at a couple of these other illnesses. One common thing from our vantage point here in the United States, these are diseases. They looked scary. They were in other countries around the world. We didn't know what to make of them at first. Let's start with Ebola and why this really lethal disease didn't end up having this kind of global impact. Can you start us there, please?
Yeah, sure. So with Ebola, it's really interesting. It's a pretty severe disease. It kills on average about 50% of people who become infected. So that's a really high rate. But the difference is that it's pretty hard to contract. So you have to be dealing with the bodily fluid of an infected person. So their blood or their sweat or their urine, which is really only going to happen if you're in a healthcare setting or if you're dealing with the body of someone who's passed from it. So it's a lot harder to contract. And it's also, you know, the symptoms are really severe, and so they're pretty identifiable. You don't have that asymptomatic transmission like we have with COVID. If somebody had Ebola, you knew it, and you knew how to take the proper precautions to try to avoid the spread.
And this is going to be a running theme, I think, in a lot of what we talk about today, that the identifiability, that you're not really spreading the disease before you have symptoms. That is really a key thing that helped people contain Ebola and some of the other illnesses we're going to talk about, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So the fact that you can spread COVID before you know you have it, when you don't have any symptoms at all, has been a really key and sort of difficult challenge with this outbreak, because it makes it so much harder to track, so much harder to prevent the spread, and it really kind of leaves us with fewer options of what to do, which is why we end up with these lockdowns, right? If you don't know you have it and you're spreading it and it's very infectious, that's a really bad combination.
Then let's look at SARS and MERS, a little more similar here in that they're both respiratory diseases mainly. Remind us a little bit of the history of those.
Right. Yeah. So SARS was in 2002 and MERS is a similar disease. They're both actually also coronaviruses. So they have a lot in common with COVID-19 in that way. What's different about them is, again, these also didn't spread as easily. They weren't transmitted from people until they had symptoms. And even then, it wasn't as easily spread. It wasn't quite as infectious as COVID is. So you had to have pretty close contact with people to get it. They actually were more deadly than COVID is, which was a problem. But because they weren't spreading as easily, we were able to contain it a little better. We were able to deal with it sort of in hospital settings rather than having to worry about it spreading rapidly through just sort of the general public.
It almost seems like that lower fatality rate of COVID-19, which is still true, I think, as far as anybody can tell, compared to SARS or MERS or for certain Ebola, it might have made us let our guard down a little bit. It looked like with such a low percentage of people who got the disease dying from it, that made it look from a distance not as serious. Is that something you saw happening?
I think so. And there's also we're still figuring out exactly what the fatality rate is. And there's a pretty good chance that it'll actually go down from what we think it is now as we get a better understanding of just how many people have had this and didn't have severe symptoms. You know, they either had no symptoms or they had a pretty mild infection and they just weren't tested. So as we discover how many people have actually had this, that fatality rate is going to go down. But the problem is, when it's so infectious, if you have enough people getting this disease, even if it has what seems like a low fatality rate of 1% or 0.5%, that ends up being a lot of people. And so we saw that to a certain extent with H1N1, because it was also very, very infectious. And it also had a pretty low fatality rate. But because so many people got it, the CDC estimates that between 151,000 and over 500,000 people died in that first year. That's a lot of people dying from this infection. And the reason why it wasn't causing the same kind of ramifications is because that fatality rate was actually even lower than what we believe COVID to be. So it's just the fact that if you have enough people getting this disease, even a low fatality rate ends up being a large number of total people.
We're talking to Kaylee Rogers from 538.com. We're talking about her piece, Why Did the World Shut Down for COVID-19, but Not Ebola, SARS, or Swine Flu? And staying with that that swine flu H1N1, which I think I might have seen in your piece, it's related to the flu that caused the big so-called Spanish influenza epidemic of about 100 years ago. It spread quickly. That was bad. Lower fatality rate. Did it have that same sort of stealth aspect that COVID-19's virus has, that people might be carrying it and not know it?
No. So this was another thing. There was some evidence that people might have been able to spread it before they were pre-symptomatic, but it didn't seem to have as big of an impact as we're seeing with COVID-19. And especially because it seems as though people can have very mild infections where they might not have any symptoms at all, or if they do, it's not for a long time. So they're still out and about and interacting with people without even knowing that they have it. And that's sort of one of the biggest problems. We kind of have this weird, unfortunate sweet spot with COVID-19 where it is very infectious, has a relatively, impactful fatality rate, and then is also spread before you even know that you have it. And so that combination makes it really difficult to control, really hard to monitor. And that's why we need testing so badly, so we can see who's had it, where is it going, and how can we stop it.
And we still don't fully understand who it's affecting and how. And I want to turn briefly to a more recent piece you wrote. You know, we heard the most vulnerable people will be older people, which has turned out to be true, or people with other conditions. But you wrote a piece looking at some younger, healthier people who are getting COVID-19 and being severely impacted by that. What kind of things did you find out?
Right. And so that's still pretty rare. You know, the biggest groups affected are older populations, but there are, you know, a few reports of these young, otherwise healthy people having to go to hospital, having to be put in ICU, and a few cases of people actually dying from this. And so there's a lot of questions there about why is this? Why could an infection that most young people can weather just fine kill some of the population? And that's true of basically any infection. There's going to be some people in an otherwise healthy group that end up succumbing to it. But the question about why is something that they're investigating right now. And so there's a lot of different potential explanations for that. One of it could be genetic. One could be the amount of virus you're exposed to when you first get infected. So if you're working in a hospital and you're dealing with patients all day, and you're getting a higher exposure to that virus versus someone just, you know, touching a can in the grocery store that maybe someone sneezed on. Those are two different levels of exposure, and that might have an impact. And so there's a lot of different potential explanations that scientists are currently looking at. But unfortunately, we just don't know yet because this is so new and they're just starting these trials and trying to untangle all of that.
Given that this is such a moving target in a lot of ways, we're learning new things about this virus every week, maybe every day. What do you have your eye on now as someone who's been covering this for a couple months?
The thing that I keep hearing repeatedly, and this is from epidemiologists, virologists, you know, people in public health, all different walks of life, is that we need to be really investing and focusing on testing. That's going to give us the best, most immediate answers and the best way to track this and try to get a control on it without having to remain in quarantine for the rest of our lives. You know, we're hoping for a vaccine someday, but that's not going to be anytime soon. And so in the meantime, the best way that we're going to be able to get any kind of information about this is if we test and test and test. And so as we hopefully start to see these new cases slow down, as we start to see the curve flatten, that should give us a bit of breathing room to start amping up those tests, testing otherwise healthy people, and getting a good sense of where we are at a population level.
Kaylee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
You too. That's Kaylee Rogers with 538. She joined us to talk about what separates the new coronavirus from other recent outbreaks. You can find her piece linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, while going through this safer at home time with kids or a partner has its challenges, people who are living alone are having their own unique issues too. Some maybe enjoying it a little more than expected, others feeling quite lonely. We'll hear about some of those stories coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, no matter what side of the aisle you stand on, many people agree that Wisconsin's April 7th election had some problems. We'll talk to a Republican and Democrat from the state Senate committee that works on election issues about what we learned and how to have a better election during a pandemic. First, we talked yesterday about some of the challenges that couples are experiencing while spending maybe more time than usual in each other's company. On the other end of the spectrum, there are a lot of people living alone right now. You can join in if you are one of them at 800-642-1234. Have you been spending these last few weeks at home alone a lot? What's it been like to you? What's been challenging? Is there some kind of upside? How do you keep in touch with people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Caroline Kitchener is a staff writer at The Lily, a publication of The Washington Post, where she covers women and gender. She wrote the piece, A Woman Living Alone, Seven Stories of Solitude During the Coronavirus, from ages 24 to 86. Caroline, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. Well, you focused on women in this piece, and you started by comparing and contrasting the big influenza epidemic just over 100 years ago and how women's lives are different. Can you set the scene for us a little there?
Absolutely. I mean, the last time that we went inside because of a virus, families looked very different. Women did not live by themselves. Women typically went right from their family home, their parents' home, to live with a husband. And if they didn't, they went to a, you know, they went to a city, they went to a boarding house where they were, you know, rooming with a bunch of other women. And now we have more women living alone in this country than ever before. So there are a whole lot of people who find themselves by themselves and, you know, having to stay inside.
And you write that in normal times, women on average tend to like that. They're cool with it. They feel pretty well connected. but you asked people to share their stories and heard from, I don't know, over 1,000 women. Can you give us a sense, before we meet some of the individual people you write about, can you give us a sense of some of the common themes you heard from these women living alone that you heard from?
For sure. I would say the number one thing that we heard was that people were very happy to have a cat or a dog. that was very popular. But I think after that, so many people talked about touch. They talked about missing hugs and holding hands and, you know, a pat on the back. It was really striking. A lot of people could tell me the exact last moment that they have someone, you know, even though it was like more than a month ago. So that was certainly something that was on the minds of people who were, you know, quarantined inside their own apartments.
And for a couple of the women you heard from and then profiled in your piece, a morning wake up call for mom or like that daily contact online or on a phone with a family member was really key. Can you talk about that?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think, you know, almost everybody that I spoke with has some sort of daily phone or, you know, more often Zoom ritual or some sort of video ritual. But those are, you know, they can, you know, sometimes make people feel a lot more connected. But for some women, too, video was difficult because, you know, when you video with friends who have families and partners and kids climbing all over them, what I heard again and again was that it actually reinforced the loneliness, sort of seeing the very, very different situation that many people find themselves in when they're quarantined with someone else. You know, people said this is an entirely different experience when you're living alone.
One of the most touching moments that you wrote about was a Betty in California, age 86, who learned to make memes for her fellow the parishioners at her church. Can you tell us a little bit about Betty's story?
Yeah, absolutely. So Betty is 86. She lives in Santa Monica, California, and she really wanted to help. She felt like she needed to be useful during this time, and she, for years, was the person in charge of finding quotes, like inspirational quotes for her church's weekly order of service. And she decided to take out that huge collection during this time and create a massive email list and create memes out of these inspirational quotes. So she learned what a meme was from a younger friend of hers, and started putting these inspirational quotes against like a backdrop of an artwork that she had created. And she sends it out every day. And I'm very happy to say that I am now on that list. So I receive a meme from Betty every day, which is really lovely. And she's just trying to, you know, find a way to connect and make people feel like, hey, somebody's looking out for me today. And I think she's really succeeded in that.
I think I want to get on that list, too. We're talking to Caroline Kitchener with the Washington Post publication, The Lily. We're talking about her piece, A Woman Living Alone, Seven Stories of Solitude During the Coronavirus from Ages 24 to 86. Let's bring out a caller. Yvette is with us in Appleton. Yvette, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess my situation, although it's unique to me, I'm sure it's not unique to everybody. I was widowed 6 months ago, and so now it's a matter of, you know, staying in place and not having the physical social contacts that, you know, I depended on so much when my husband initially died, but now being alone all the time. So it's not just when I'm home and, of course, at times when he would have been here, but now it's, you know, it's just an all-the-time thing. But the other thought that I find myself working to keep in mind is I'm not the only one going through loss right now. Of course, my family and close friends are grieving the loss of my husband, their father, their friend, but everybody I know has lost their ability to move around, to go for coffee, to go for lunch, to go for dinner, to have some sort of freedom that we've all become so accustomed to. So, again, I feel like I'm a part of a greater group of grieving people that have experienced some sort of loss in a way.
Yvette, I'm so sorry for your loss, and that it's being amplified, you know, by this situation now. But you are not alone. You talked to Irma, Caroline, who had just lost her husband before this.
Yvette, I'm so sorry to hear about your husband. I did talk to a woman who 61, who lives in outside of Chicago, and her husband passed away 18 months ago. And this has been just an unthinkably hard time for her. I cried during an interview for the first time in a long time. I was really moved by talking to her. She spoke about how she's been talking to her husband now much more than before. She'll go into her sunroom where his urn is, and she'll talk to it on Saturday morning. She'll bring her breakfast in there and just kind of sit quietly and think about what he would have said and what he would have done during this time. And I think she's found that to be really hard, but comforting too, to kind of hear his voice in her head saying, you know, we're fine. We're going to get through this. She can kind of feel like he's still there in some ways.
Thanks, Yvette, so much for that call. Our hearts are with you. Thank you for sharing that story. Can you talk a little bit, Caroline, about how people kind of tried, even if they weren't mourning, they are mourning a loss of their daily lives. Can you talk about how they struggled in some cases and hopefully found ways to keep their mental health in a good state?
Absolutely. I think I heard from people who were doing a wide array of things. A lot of people being really creative and finding joy wherever they can. I actually talked to a woman whose name is Joy, and she is very much of the mindset of, you know, we cannot let ourselves despair. We've got to pick ourselves up. We've got to literally move. She was a big proponent of dancing in the middle of the day just because, like, just turn up your music and put on something really happy that just makes you want to move and just sort of be in the music and enjoy it and not feel like you have to do anything. I think there's a lot of the women that wrote in spoke about sort of the pressure to be productive during this time. Like, we're home, I better make the most of it. I better, you know, write that paper or finally learn how to, you know, be Spanish, whatever. But, you know, Joy was really a proponent of, no, just be with this idle time and celebrate it. And, you know, there's so much despair everywhere. Let's really try to find some happiness wherever we can.
And Caroline, in our last minute or so, coming out of this, did you get a sense of maybe the value of reaching out to people we know who are living alone, whether they're friends or family members? Go for it. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. This rings very true right now because right after the piece published, I was absolutely flooded with notes. There's one woman that I talk about in the piece, Hazel, who is struggling to get groceries. She lives in New York and she doesn't really know anyone. And, she has a cough and she can't go out. And, I must've gotten like 50 people contacted me saying, you know, can I please send Hazel groceries? And Hazel herself, I don't know how people got her information, but it was a little overwhelming. She's just hearing from all these people she doesn't know. And I just wrote back to all these people saying, you know, Hazel's good. Hazel's all set, but please, please check on your neighbors because you never know who needs a little something. So,
Caroline, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This is great.
That's Caroline Kitchener, staff writer at The Lily. That's a publication of The Washington Post. She covers women and gender there. She wrote a piece under the headline, A Woman Living Alone, 7 Stories of Solitude During the Coronavirus from Ages 24 to 86. Coming up, we'll hear from a Republican and a Democrat in the state Senate about how to improve the voting process while Wisconsin continues to battle the coronavirus outbreak. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, check out some of the newest high-tech gadgets on the market, the latest smartphone models, and more. That's Monday morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin's April 7th election has gotten widespread criticism. Voters were encouraged to vote absentee amid concerns about the coronavirus and crowded polling places. But many voters across the state reported not receiving their ballots in the mail, and those who voted in person wore masks to protect themselves, some waiting in long lines for hours. So with a special election next month and the 2020 presidential election not that far away, what can we do to make voting in a pandemic work better and more safely? State Senator Kathy Bernier is a Republican who represents Wisconsin's 23rd State Senate District, which includes Chippewa Falls. She's also chair of the State Senate Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rural Issues. Senator Bernier, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
And State Senator Mark Miller is a Democrat who represents the 16th State Senate District, including Monona. He also sits on that Committee on Elections. Senator Miller, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Rob, and good afternoon, Senator Bernier.
Good afternoon, Senator Miller.
And Senator Bernier, let's start with you. Do you have a sense of maybe lessons learned from April 7th and things that we might need to change here in the state?
Yes. Yes, I do. I think we probably need to quickly, which I've encouraged some of my colleagues to do, we didn't finish our last session day in the Senate, and we have a system, an alternative voting system that would allow early voters to cast their ballots into the machines. They would be tabulated within the machine, and they would be held in ballot bags. It's called the absentee voting efficiency option, which many of our larger municipalities would be able to accommodate. That we need to incorporate. We cannot reduce the number of polling places as they did in Milwaukee and Green Bay. so drastically that we accumulate that many more people in one spot. That needs to be, you know, if they had 100 poll workers in each polling place in Milwaukee, they could have had probably 20 with, you know, 20, 25 poll workers each. So those were some of the lessons I learned. I went to some of the polling places I was at, saw that they had plexiglass, they had safety, security, and that was a good thing. I think that will have to continue.
And Senator Miller, how about your lessons learned and possible changes?
Well, it's certainly true that if we're going to have large absentee ballots coming in, is the clerks need to have another option for counting ballots. Currently, they can only count the ballots on election day, and they could continue to count them until they're all counted. And so what Senator Bernier was referring to was a proposal that would have allowed the clerks to put a voting machine out in the lobby of and allow people to come in, fill out an absentee ballot, and submit it into the counting machine, the tally machine, right away. That would have the advantage of not having to count those ballots on election day. It would also allow that if a voter spoiled their ballot by voting for too many people in one office or made some other mistake voting improperly, and the tally machine recognized it, that they'd be able to correct their ballot. The problem with that, as I see it, is that there would be voting machines unattended out in the lobby where people could be suspicious that perhaps they were could be tampered with while nobody was watching them or while their people were inattentive. And I think anything that sort of raises the question about whether or not the ballots or the machines were tampered with is serious. We have in Wisconsin, and then there was another proposal which said, all right, we'll just allow clerks and local municipalities to make a decision as to whether or not they want to count ballots on the Monday before the election. Now, neither one of these proposals passed the legislature, but I think many clerks would have liked to have one option or the other, and I think it's something that absolutely needs to be done because the number of absentee ballots that voters are submitting is going to continue to increase. It's very popular. And in the case of a pandemic like we had here just last time, April 7th, voting in a pandemic, it was much more than we've ever seen before in terms of the number of ballots submitted. So I think those are two things that actually need to be done, is to provide one or the other and hopefully give local municipalities the option to either do them all at once. The advantage of doing them all at once is that poll watchers could watch, make sure that all the machines and the ballots are managed together. It would have the advantage to the clerks that they would be able to have they'd be able to space out their workers and have some of them doing the work on a day when they don't also have to administer the election for what drive-in voters.
Talking to State Senator Kathy Bernier and State Senator Mark Miller, a Republican and Democrat, respectively, about elections in Wisconsin in the midst of the pandemic. Senator Bernier, something a lot of people were talking about around Election Day was either, hey, should we switch to mail-in only voting, or the idea of sending everybody a ballot to have the option to mail it in, something that we couldn't turn around fast enough for that April 7th election. What do you think of one of those options?
Well, in all mail voting system takes years to accomplish. And I will quote the Office of Secretary of State, Director of Elections, Lori Aguino. I don't know if I pronounced her name right, but she did send an email, and I got all the documentations from Megan Wolf from the Elections Commission. You know, all of a sudden everybody wants to vote by mail, and she gave a long list of provisions and criteria and processes that needed to be followed, and they did percentage by percentage by percentage for a number of years before they went full 100% mail ballots. So it's not something that you can pull off in 1 year. It's not something you can probably pull off in 2 years. So the idea that anyone can think, you know, and Mark probably knows this, those of us who deal with elections, and I did as a county clerk, there are minute detailed processes that you follow for every single thing that you do to administer elections, from preparing for them all the way through election day and all the way through counting. So those processes are not something that you can just flip a switch and go from voting on election day to all of a sudden everybody is going to mail in. There will be different deadlines for requesting a ballot. There will be different deadlines for everything, including I would question whether we could even accomplish, if we wanted to do all mail-in, election day registration. We would have to question that, because that's where everybody piles up on election day, not so much casting their ballot, but registering and changing their addresses and all of that. So it's not something you would be able to accomplish easily by the professionals who have advised us on that. The other thing you cannot really count on at this point, because it proved that the United States Postal Service was not able to handle our ballots that we had. We had 1.1 million ballots, and one spouse would get a ballot, and then the other one didn't, so they ended up having to go to the polls. Fortunately, we had polls open for people to go to when they didn't receive their ballots. So it's easier said than done. Exclamation point.
And Senator Miller, let's jump on that point. I think there's a lot of concern about what Senator Bernier just brought up, the ballots that didn't ultimately make it to people or didn't make it on time. What are you on that committee looking at when it comes to what happened there with the ballots that people requested and how to make sure they get there in future elections?
Well, that's being investigated, and there's not been any results from that investigation. The U.S. Postal Service in Wisconsin apparently was not equipped to handle the volume of mail that happened on such a short notice. But in the five states where they do have mail in booked by mail, the post office has mobilized its resources to be able to handle that additional surge. But here in Wisconsin, because it happened unexpectedly, they were not prepared for that, and it appears that there were some lost ballots in the process, and that's unacceptable. So we have to be able to deal with that. But the states that have already done it provide us a template for the way that you can accomplish the mail-in ballots. And the process basically is that every registered voter at a certain fixed period prior to the election, say 3 weeks, would be mailed a ballot, and they would have a certain amount of time to return that ballot, or they could bring it. They could either mail it back, or they could bring it to the clerk and turn it in, sort of similar to the way we do our absentee ballots now. Or they could go and vote in person, even though they'd gotten a ballot in the mail. They wouldn't have to use that. Voter participation is somewhat higher in those states that do it. It's done in both in states that are controlled by Republicans and some that are controlled by Democrats. And so it has proved to be effective in both Republican-controlled states and Democratic-controlled states.
We're talking to two state senators from the Senate Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rural Issues about how to improve the voting process during the coronavirus outbreak. Republican State Senator Kathy Bernier is with us, along with her Democratic colleague, State Senator Mark Miller. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How can we make voting work better for you, especially during a time of pandemic? Would you be in favor of an access to a downloadable ballot that you could print out and mail in yourself? That's something that's been recommended in other states. What do you think about the idea of mailing elections? What problems did you encounter during the election yourself as a voter, as a poll worker? Love to hear your experience. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about lessons learned from Wisconsin's April 7th election and how we can improve elections while dealing with the reality of the coronavirus outbreak. We have two state senators with us, Mark Miller and Kathy Bernier, Democrat and Republican, respectively. They're both on the key Elections Committee in the Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What would you like to see done differently? What did you encounter in this month's election? Did it work smoothly for you? Did you have some kind of snag with getting a ballot, with a long line at the voting place, working as a poll worker yourself? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to your calls now. Lisa starts us off in Oconomowoc. Lisa, hello.
Hello. My issue with my absentee ballot is it did come in time, and I'm in the Heartland area. I completed it very carefully, but I did make a mistake in that it requires a witness signature, and that's not very clear. I had assumed I only need a witness signature if I had somebody else filling it out for me. So I did not have anybody witness my signature, and therefore my ballot was sent back to me as invalid about a day after the in-person election. So I was pretty disappointed about that. I was just hoping that could be kind of cleared up on our forms. And I also really like the idea that was suggested about online being able to print out your ballot or making sure everybody gets an absentee ballot and has that option.
Lisa, thanks a lot for that call. I know there are some people had confusion who are maybe voting with that absentee ballot for the first time. Also concerns if I'm sheltering at home, how do I get a witness if I live alone? Brief thoughts on that from both of you. Let's start with Senator Miller this time.
Yes, I don't think it's necessary for a witness to witness the signature of the voter who is certifying that they are the person who submitted the ballot. Something that is easy to miss, and it I think unnecessarily invalidates the absentee ballot of the voter. Similarly, in the COVID-19, there's a requirement on the ballot to include a copy of your valid ID, because Wisconsin has a voter ID requirement, and many households do not have the capability of copying their driver's license or Wisconsin ID or other form of valid ID to include. Now, I personally am not in favor of the voter ID provision in our current laws that you have to show when you show up to vote. I think you prove who you are and you prove your residence at the time that you register, and so that when the ballot is mailed to you or sent to you, and is filled out by the voter and he certifies that he's the voter, that should be sufficient.
And Senator Bernier?
Well, the witness signature is to verify. So if we do 1.1 million absentee ballots and they get around and somebody takes someone else's ballot, the witness verifies that, in fact, Kathy Bernier is the voter here. So it's a safeguard. You know, whether we have a real problem with that or not is a question. The photo ID, I know a lot of people needed some help getting one mailed out. Those individuals that don't routinely vote absentee. Now, if you are have a smartphone, most people who now use smartphones, it was very simple. You just took a picture of your ID and you uploaded the photo right on My Vote, and a lot of people had no problem with that. But our older folks do have problems with that, and getting them to check the mark that they're indefinitely confined would have foregone that requirement. If in fact they're older, which age did play a part in that indefinitely confined criteria. So, you know, under these circumstances, had we had more time to, gear up for this, we probably could have taken more things into account. But as in everything, we get courts involved and lawyers involved. And then sometimes they make matters worse, and at the 11th hour make different decisions and different rules. And so the whole thing was pretty darn confusing from beginning to end. But, you know, all in all, I'm a glass half full kind of woman. All in all, there was a really huge voter turnout for an April election. 1.1 million people voted absentee, and 450,000 people voted in person. And the safeguards were there, and the study just that came out today, I'm sure you saw it, said that there was not an uptick in our numbers from the April 7th election. So amen to that.
Talking to State Senators Kathy Bernier and Mark Miller about voting in Wisconsin. Back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Wausau. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Actually, it's Jeff, but that's okay.
Oh, Jeff. I'm sorry, Jeff.
That's all right. Good afternoon, Senators. This whole process, I'm a 68-year-old, but this whole process seems to me needs to be revamped. I'll go back and I'll answer part of my question because I know there's going to be a rebut on this. Do you remember the days of Internet cafes? Everybody had access to a computer through an Internet cafe. So that's going to be part of the answer I've got coming up. We live in 2020. We're in the 21st century. Why in the world doesn't everybody of voting age or that has a Social Security number or a federal ID be assigned a PIN where they can simply do their voting online? We don't have a hand.
Thanks for the call. We don't have a ton of time left. Dennis saying, hey, how about some online voting? And it sounds like he has some logistical ideas for people without the technology to do it themselves. Briefly, Senator Bernier, your thoughts on trying to allow online voting?
Well, I would have a conversation if I were you with the Department of Homeland Security and all of the shenanigans that are going on in cyber space right now, and the problems with the previous presidential election. The last thing that I would ever consider is doing things on the internet in regard to our election security.
Senator Miller.
Yeah, this is something I agree with Senator Bernier on. I think the vulnerability of the internet system is such that it could really disrupt our the validity of our elections with the sophistication of the ability to hack the internet. We have in Wisconsin, the voter fills out a paper ballot. Those paper ballots are a hard copy of the voter's intent. They're always there, and you can always verify, go back if you need to, and verify what the voter actually did, because we have those paper ballots that the voters themselves filled out by hand. We have a vulnerability in that the machines that count those ballots could be hacked. But if there was evidence that they were hacked, then we can discover that by mm-hmm. doing what's called risk-based auditing. We could always go back and just hand count those ballots, and then we could overcome that vulnerability.
Thanks
Agreed.
For that call. I just want to ask each of you briefly. You know, there's always a suspicion with any change. If one party proposes it, the other party is worried that it's, going to give a partisan advantage. Just briefly,
really?
believe it. I know it's hard to believe. Senator Miller, let's start with you. Can you and your colleagues come up with bipartisan solutions here?
Well, you know, that brings up a really important fundamental thing, and that is that it has traditionally been that parties try to look for to get advantages in the electoral system to support their partisan advantage. But that undermines the confidence of voters in the credibility of the election. And in a democratic system like we have, voters absolutely need to have confidence that the votes that they cast are counted correctly and are not impaired by unnecessary bureaucratic obstructions. One of those things that would help to improve that is the drawing of legislative maps that would reflect the results of how the voters voted. In Wisconsin, we have basically a 50-50 division between Republicans and Democrats. And so the results of legislative elections and statewide elections should...
Gotcha on that point, Senator Miller. Okay. I want to give Senator Bernier a quick moment on the bipartisanship issue as well.
Yeah, I think to get back to the point is what can we do under circumstances, emergency circumstances? All elected officials have an emergency response plan on file, as well as the Wisconsin Election Commission. I don't think they had taken into consideration pandemics, but I think that they can do this in a more efficient manner. I think what we would probably look at, although most people got the message to vote absentee, some of them did it very late in the process, which was part of the problem. We could send postcards out. A couple of individuals in the assembly are proposing that the election commission send out postcards, please vote absentee, and here's how you do it.
Thanks to both of our guests today, Senators Kathy Bernier and Mark Miller, Republican and Democrat respectively, both on a key Senate Elections Committee talking about voting here in the state. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a doctor answers your questions about the latest COVID-19 information and misinformation. That and a lot more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 6, a lot of plants and animals make a big appearance in the spring in Wisconsin, and insects are a part of that parade. Kate talks to a Wisconsin expert on some of the state's smallest wildlife creatures, and you can share your own sightings, for better or worse. That's Monday at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then on Food Friday, we'll hear about some creative ways to reduce food waste in our kitchens. So don't throw away those brown banana peels. You could turn them into a cake. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Your next great meal might just come from your garden. From simple tomato pots to a backyard bounty of fruits and vegetables, get helpful gardening advice.
So many of us are trying to grow more produce in less space or with less time.
Anytime we see issues with our plants, you have to do horticulture CSI.
Join me, Larry Mueller, for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Fridays at 11 and Saturday mornings at 6 or online anytime.
PBS Wisconsin is proud to offer Bright by Text, a free texting service for parents and caregivers of children ages 8 and younger. Text the word BADGER to 274-448 and receive research-based, age-specific resources and activities from trusted content partners like PBS Kids. Get free educational resources delivered to your phone with Bright by Text from PBS Wisconsin. Just text BADGER to 274-448.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. Following remarks at yesterday's coronavirus task force briefing, where President Donald Trump talked about the effects of humidity, sunlight, and disinfectants on the coronavirus,